Esther 9, verses 11 through 13. On that day, the number of those that were slain in Shushan the palace was brought before the king. And the king said unto Esther the queen, "The Jews have slain and destroyed 500 men in Shushan the palace, and the 10 sons of Haman. What have they done in the rest of the king's provinces? Now, what is thy petition? And it shall be granted thee. Or what is thy request further? And it shall be done." Then said Esther, "If it please the king, let it be granted to the Jews which are in Shushan to do tomorrow also according unto this day's decree, and let Haman's 10 sons be hanged upon the gallows." We know the great day of battle between the seed of the serpent and the seed of the woman has arrived. And curiously, although it seemed to have been set by Haman in his appeal to fate through the casting of the lot, it's proved to be the day of God's appointment for the deliverance of his people. You know, it's a funny thing that the heathen, particularly the Persians, when they cast lots, they would cast them into a pot, and they would peer into that pot as if to keep out any sort of outside influence. And yet, somehow, in this story, God has overruled and shown himself to be greater in his absence, because his name isn't even mentioned in the book, than the presence of these Persian deities or the fates in the casting of the lot. So truly we can say with Solomon in Proverbs 16:33, "The lot is cast into the lap, but the whole disposing thereof is of the Lord." It's notable the word "disposing" in the Hebrew there is the Hebrew word for judgment. So the lot is an appeal to the Lord to bring forth judgment, or a legal disposition, which is what judgment connotes. It's an appeal for a legal judgment upon the parties who are in contest. On this day, then, the Persians were made to see the legal disposition, the outcome, which was presented to them by an overruling hand of the Almighty on behalf of Israel. Haman thought that he was in contest with Israel, but he thought that he had finally found a day when the fates, when fortune or chance or luck or whatever he might have called it, would have smiled upon him. But he finds all of that is to no avail. Now, though the name of God is not openly acknowledged, we know that his providence is continually seen throughout this book. And in his people, we see his singular care for their welfare, for their preservation. Everything here is set in place. This is part of his judgment or his disposal of this series of events. Everything has been set in place for the defense of the Jews. Think about how far this has gone. The power and the institutions of the Persian kingdom itself have now been turned to their favor. And that's something which I would suggest would be unimaginable apart from the secret providence of God. Again, we need to consider the slaughter that was wrought by the Jews against their enemies. This slaughter, the way it's carried out, is often viewed as a troublesome annoyance for Christians. Modern commentators in particular have a problem with what the Jews are doing here. I will say that some of the older commentators, and there aren't a lot on Esther, but some of them, particularly the Reformed commentators that I could find, they don't seem to have those kinds of reservations about the actions of the Jews and this notion that Esther was motivated by something less than a Christian spirit. But these modern commentators are they find this troublesome what the Jews are doing here. After all, they would say, we're told, aren't we to love our enemies and to do good to those who despitefully use us, and so on. And of course, this teaching is right and good because it's the teaching of our Lord. However, what these Jews did in this situation was also right and good. Because what they did was of the nature of self-defense in the service of their brethren. Moreover, their position was not so much that of executing justice against those that were private enemies. These were not. This is not vengeance in a private grudge match. These aren't merely their enemies, but these are the enemies of God that they're assaulting here. In addition, we have to remember they did this with the support of what appears to be a newly converted magistrate. The king is now on their side. So there's no reason to believe that these Jews at the time are moved by some private spirit of revenge. And that's what the scripture condemns when, for example, the apostle says in Romans 12:19, dearly beloved, avenge not yourselves, but rather give place unto wrath, for it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord. A few verses later, he goes into explaining that there is something of a power ordained of God that will bear the sword, that is, the ordinance of God in civil magistracy. These Jews, then, were not moved by this private spirit, but they were moved, I think, by a public spirit and a concern for the Word of God. And what they did, I think we also need to keep in mind, they did with the full consent and blessing of the prophet of God at the time, Mordecai. Nor did they exceed the bounds of justice, as I've noted several times and will have reason to point out again in the verses before us today. Fact is, they exacted a strict justice upon those who were arrayed against the true religion. What they did only after fair warning had been given. These opponents of theirs had ample opportunity to change their course. You know, if they had been a little bit more worldly wise, they should have read their fate written in the tea leaves, as it were, when they got that second decree. Should have been enough for them to lay down their arms and cease their hostilities. So while this is not prescriptive for us as individuals, it's not teaching us what we can do with our private enemies, it is a very good indication of what a godly civil magistrate is warranted to do on behalf of the true faith once that faith has been afforded a national establishment. Now, additionally, it is indicative of the fact that Christians may, under a magistrate who is inclined to support the true faith, that they may lawfully take part in the suppression of those things in a society which they know to be subversive and destructive of the true religion. There's nothing contrary to the Christian faith in defending the faith by the sword. There is something contrary to the spirit of Christianity if we seek to propagate the faith by the sword. But once people have believed, or once a society has embraced this faith, That is not to say that the society all of a sudden is defenseless in the face of a hostile world. Whereas the scriptures tell us that the tender mercies of the wicked are cruel in Proverbs 12, verse 10, we should gather from what we read here that the harsh strokes of the righteous are actually merciful. Just as it is not only just but merciful to execute someone who would murder the body, it's merciful to suppress and even at times destroy those who would corrupt and destroy the souls of ourselves and others. And so the psalmist says in Psalm 141:5, "Let the righteous smite me, it shall be a kindness." It's just, merciful, and a common benefit to all men to suppress wickedness in a society. And that includes spiritual wickedness. For that end, for that very end, Paul tells us in Romans 13 that the sword has been entrusted to those who are charged with maintaining public order. And when there are movements against the true faith, when the faith is nationally established, and there are movements against it that affect the public order and the faith as it affects the public order, the sword can be used to maintain public order against such persons. Now, I know that's not popular democratic theory, but that is what the Word of God teaches. Now, we see in the listing of the names of Haman's sons that the contest between the Jews and their enemies is not only between true and false religion, but we see that the notion that a non-Christian state is not neutral toward the faith being held out here. Non-Christian states are not neutral. I noted very early in our survey of the book of Esther that the name of Haman and the identifying of him as the son of Hammedatha pointed to his priesthood and to the elevated status. His elevation is indicating the elevated status of Persian fire worshippers, Zoroastrians. That's the name. They're fire worshippers in the Persian kingdom. And as we've examined the names of his sons, we've seen that each name bore a peculiar relation to this heathen worship. As I noted, the variants that are found in the Hebrew text represent distorted forms of the Persian names, and those distorted forms are meant to mock them in their death, much like Elijah mocked the prophets of Baal. Those who executed Haman's sons are mocking them in death by affixing to them distortions of their names that are making fun of them, that are pointing out how the providence of the true God has overcome the fates of the heathen gods. So their condemnation and removal signifies a thorough purging of all who held the pagan worldview of these fire worshippers from the government. That's the significance of their removal here at this point. The point, however, I wish to make here is there's no such thing as neutrality in the state. Nature abhors a vacuum. And the idea that neutrality could fill that vacuum is a myth. Now, it's a powerful myth, to be sure, especially in Western post-Christian Enlightenment thought. But it is a myth nonetheless. The fact is, there is no such thing as a secular realm that's untouched by the concerns of the sacred or religion. Religion affects everything. And everyone has a religion, whether they know it or not. Everyone is worshiping, whether they know it or not. Because there's no secular realm, because there's no place untouched by the concerns of true religion, that's why the Apostle says in 2 Corinthians 10 that we're to cast down imaginations and every high thing that exalteth itself against the knowledge of God, and bringing into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ. Now it's true, as the Apostle also says in the preceding verse, the weapons of our warfare are not carnal. By this, he means only what I noted before. We're not called upon to persuade men at the point of the sword. We're not trying to get them to profess the true religion at the point of the sword. However, again, as I've noted, this does not preclude the right of the magistrate to defend that faith once it's been established by law. I want you to note here, neither Esther nor Mordecai ever used force to move Ahasuerus to embrace their faith or to look favorably upon the true religion. And yet when he did, again, we're not going to get into whether or not his faith was genuine. I know that there are all kinds of questions about that that have been raised, but assuming for the moment the outward veracity of what he's doing, that it's good, once he outwardly ties himself to the faith, they not only did not forsake his help, they request his aid in overturning what was at once an unjust and very wicked decree, as well as an assault on the true religion in the form of that first decree that was sent out by Haman. As I said, the Persian state had never been neutral in spiritual matters. It had always taken a position because, in fact, like every civil government tends to reflect the beliefs of the people under it. If there's no conscious embrace and establishing of the true faith, there is this default mode in which a government will simply reflect the state of religion or irreligion of its populace. And that, too, as I said, reflects a religious commitment. The Persian state had never been neutral. In Persia, the religion of the people was that of Zoroastrianism and the fire worship that went along with it. Zoroastrianism is one of the oldest heathen religions that is known to those who study the history of religion. Now, when the dominant heathen religion in this situation is brought face to face with the claims of the true religion, the same thing tends to happen wherever and whenever this occurs. There's a flashpoint. And you get a reaction much like Haman, which seeks to bring actual persecution upon the faithful if possible. And if not actual persecution, then there will be this virtual persecution or attempt at suppression. The fact is, interestingly enough, in the history of the world, nation states have never been neutral with respect to Christianity. They're always, whenever they're faced with Christianity, they're always interacting with it, because Christianity is presenting to them a worldview. It's asking them to look at everything from a different point of view. That's why when we read in the book of Acts, the apostles are said to have turned the world upside down by preaching the gospel. And everything that the pagans think is good, they find out is not only not good, it's probably a lie. So this has been the story of the church from its earliest days, this kind of interacting with nation states. And it was certainly the case here in Persia. And yet throughout the history of the church, the Lord has never allowed the heathen to gain the upper hand to such a degree as they were empowered to destroy the church entirely. Now, it may be that Esther's day was much like the time of the early reign, when the church flowered early on in its history, around the time of Constantine. When you have a heathen ruler who appears to be converted and gives his strength to fortify the church. Now, Constantine's a very controversial figure. And in the early church, the conversion of Constantine actually had a mixed result. And all of a sudden, you have the heathen pouring into the church because of the civil preferments that would accrue to them if they aligned themselves with the Christian faith, the faith of the emperor. And from that mixed result arose Antichrist. But as I've been hinting, I think that this story in Esther is really pointing us to that time shortly prior to the millennium, and even ushering in the millennial time, when the Jews being converted, the fullness of the Gentiles are brought in, and the nations will profess Christ together. So during this period leading up to the millennium, when the nations are no longer deceived by Satan, as we see in Revelation 20, the result of a ruler being converted, I think we should understand, is going to be much more favorable than Constantine and much more long-lasting. It's going to last until that rebellion that we see at the very end of the millennium, shortly prior to the second coming of Christ. And in the meanwhile, between now and then, we should note that neutrality is a lie. Secularism is a myth. And every action of the state, as well as its citizens, contains a profession of some faith. Every day, in every way, you are choosing and confessing your religion. The only question is, which faith is being confessed? The creation is constrained to give a continual account of itself to God. It can't ignore this. And that account is going to be either one of unbelief or one of belief, but there's no middle ground. Now, in demonstration of this, and with some applicability to our times, and with reference to the verses that we covered last time, let me call your attention again to the names of the 10 sons of Haman. Haman knew the value, the power, and the messaging of naming his children. He took great care, evidently, to impress upon each one of them a name that he would carry throughout his life, a name that would constantly remind him of his connection, not only to his family, but to the heathenish religion of his father. Haman understood every time someone addressed these sons, they'd be reminded of their familial faith and the need to aspire to be worthy of the names that were given to them. It's also noteworthy that Haman understood that in naming them, he was devoting them to his gods, which were, of course, nothing but demons. Now, the Jews also understood the value, power, and messaging of names. And that's why, exactly why, they were careful to distort and mock the names when they give them here. Now, anyone who's ever had his or her name mispronounced or mistaken knows the discomfort you feel when someone does that. But it's even more uncomfortable when people take your name and deliberately distort it in order to mock you. In that, you sense that your name is not something simply outside of you or tangentially related to you, but somehow your name is connected to you, because it is. A good name, as Solomon notes, is better than precious ointment or expensive perfume, as some translations read, Ecclesiastes 7:1. To ridicule and cast aspersions on the names of Haman's sons was to chase down and destroy their memories even in death. It's no mistake that throughout the New Testament gospel accounts, Jesus is continually renaming his disciples, because in renaming them, he's recommissioning and repurposing them. As Christians, we should take very seriously, then, the task of naming of our children. Adam called things what they were. And that was the power of a man before the fall, to be able to look at something and see what it was. It is primarily the duty of fathers to name their children, not of mothers. That's a modern, sentimental point of view. It's not to say that the desires of the wife should not be taken into account. But we remember in the naming of John the Baptist, when John was told, when the people were told his name is John by his mother, they said, well, no one in the family has ever been named John before. And then they asked his father, and when his father confirmed it, not only was his tongue loosed and he could speak, but they then accepted that. It's the duty of fathers to ponder their children, to pray about naming their children. It's irresponsible to name children without giving serious thought as to the character and the hopes that we wish to place before them for their personal development and for the enrichment of those around them. Names should not only sound pleasant to the ears, but they should also reflect the faith and hope of the parents. And even Haman understood this. It's amazing that we've gotten so far away from this in modern society. People have no idea that when you simply give someone a name without meaning, a name just because it sounds good, a name because it's something that just appeals to your flesh, that you are in fact defining something about that child. It's hard enough to do it when we have an eye to the faith. Look how many times Jesus had to take aside his disciples and say, no, you're not Simon, you're Peter. You're not Saul, you're Paul. It used to be that even the heathen understood this principle, and now it's not even understood in the church. Naming children to fulfill some sort of romantic hope or dream, or because some name sounds cute, or it just somehow appeals to your aesthetic sense, is to impress upon your child vanity. The word vanity means emptiness. You're instilling in that child a principle of emptiness. You're not giving them any root. You're depriving them of a rootedness in family, which is what happens when children are born out of wedlock and they're denied the familial name, and in the hope of faith, when you give them some name that really has no meaning but some whim, some passing fancy of your own. So let's look at verse 11. On that day, the number of those that were slain in Shushan the palace was brought before the king. On that day. Now, some have translated this on that very day, because it emphasizes something here in the Hebrew text. It emphasizes what is being stressed. There's stress upon the day of the slaughter, meaning the 13th day of Adar. And the notion that comes into play here is that what follows is joined very hard to what has preceded. The sense here is that no sooner had this slaughter been concluded, probably by the setting of the sun, no sooner has it been concluded that there was a report gone out. And so while it is on this very day, it is most likely that what we have in front of us should be understood to be later in the day, early evening, around the time, or shortly after dusk. So they've reached the end of the day's work. And just like that verdict God gives at the end of each day of creation, you know, it was good, it was good, it was good, it was very good, so too, there needs to be a verdict about this day. Well, on that day, the number of those that were slain. The report here consisted then of the number of the slain. And in fact, it was not an uncommon practice among the ancients, especially in times of battle. Fact is, we have extant records from the Babylonian era of very exacting numbers being given of the slain. Right? They would say, you know, 263 or something like that, 172, 3,021, numbers like that. They were not numbers rounded up or covered with some symbolical figure in its stead. Probably because when you're going to war at that time, troop size often made the difference, and so each warrior was counted with precision. You wanted to know where you stood at the end of the day. How many warriors do you have left on the battlefield? And nonetheless, though we have examples of this kind of precision in other records, the record in front of us, this number 500, seems to be more of a rough estimation. In fact, I would suggest the numbers noted here are more likely to carry some kind of symbolic significance to either the Jews or the Persians, perhaps even to both. Not that they're not actual numbers, but we can have numbers that are pretty close approximations And if we present them rounded up or rounded down numbers that have some other significance, it can be very helpful in connecting events. And so there may be some of that. On that day, the number of those that were slain in Shushan the palace. So the number that is being recorded, or the report being brought, is not a reckoning of all of those who've been killed throughout the kingdom. That would have been an impossibility this soon after, right? We're just at probably, as I say, sunset, dusk, something like that. It'd be impossible. Remember how long it took to send out the first and second decrees. They needed time and more than just a few minutes or a few hours. It's true, the Persians did have one of the fastest communication systems in the ancient world. But it could not have sent news from the far reaches that quickly. Quickly, but not that quickly. Right? The news is going to come. We're going to see that. Instead, the reckoning here is restricted to Shushan, the fortress or the palace. Now, nothing of significance could happen in the empire without news reaching the palace. And so, of course, how much more the things which happened in the royal complex that day? Right? How were you going to keep this from the king? So, on that day, the number of those who were slain in Shushan the palace was brought before the king. Now, who brought the report, we're not told. Some of the rabbis thought that this report was brought by the enemies of the Jews, and that they brought it in order to turn the king against them, to say, look, aha, look what these Jews have done in the palace. If that's true, we can gather from what follows that their design failed mightily. What is clear from this is this. The king was kept informed about the events of the day. And this, as I've mentioned, was to be expected. Now, importantly, knowing that the king would receive such reports would surely have been a check to keep the Jews from moving into any excess in carrying this out. Knowing the king had a very carefully established chain of communication would provide some restraint for anyone who might have felt himself at liberty to go beyond that prescribed remedy that had been outlined in that second decree. So verse 12. And the king said unto Esther the queen, the Jews have slain and destroyed 500 men in Shushan the palace and the 10 sons of Haman. What have they done in the rest of the king's provinces? Now, what is thy petition? And it shall be granted thee. Or what is thy request further? And it shall be done. The king said unto Esther the queen. So what we have is this. He's received the report. The king now turns to Esther. And here, her royal status is mentioned because he's given this to her not merely as his wife, but this is the result of a gift he's given her as his queen. Now remember, Esther represents the true church established by law, even as Mordecai stands for the true religion as it functions prophetically, informing the civil magistrate of his duty before God. And so thus, here, I would say the king seeks from his queen a response. Should we read this through our rabbinic lenses, we would hear the voice of God speaking to his church. Because only the king, Hamalek, the king, is mentioned without the name of Ahasuerus. Now, certainly this is also true. You know, Esther here is speaking as the representative of the true church of God. And she would have every reason to hear the voice of God speaking to her in what the king is saying, because she knew the hand of God was in this whole affair. Should we hear the voice of the king as we would reading this naturally, what we shall hear is not merely a king speaking without anger or remorse about the day's deeds, but maybe we actually hear the king being somewhat boastful, somewhat playful in speaking to her. Now keep in mind, there seems to be a bit of him that sounds like he's pleased with what he's facilitated on her behalf throughout the kingdom here. King said unto Esther, the queen, the Jews have slain and destroyed 500 men in Shushan the palace. First, then, look, he's noticing the number of the slain in Shushan. And I've spoken to the 500 and noted that they were most likely men. In the Hebrew there, designated them as ish, men, males. And particularly that they were likely men who were placed throughout the government who were in agreement, if not in league, with Haman. There seems to be, in what the king is saying, a bit of admiration then when he relates what the Jews have done. And that may well be because if you remember some time ago when Haman was telling him, we can get rid of all of these Jews, he insinuated that you're really not going to miss them. Won't be a big deal if they go away. Nobody's going to miss them when they're gone. But now, given the events of the day, the king has actually found out these Jews are valuable warriors, potentially, if he should call upon them in that capacity. They've demonstrated a capability that may well have exceeded his expectations for the day. He may have thought, oh, they're going to prevail because they've got, you know, the wind of the royal favor at their back. But he seems to relate this in a way that is either there's some admiration or some boasting. There's anything but remorse or anger or disgust at what's happened. None of that is there. Now the king here uses the same terms that were used early on when he says the Jews have killed, meaning that they'd slaughtered, and then he affixes to this an additional word, which means destroyed, abaddon, meaning that they would, they're from the word from which we get abaddon, meaning that they destroyed them from the face of the earth. Of course, if he understood the significance of that, he would have understood that removing them from the face of the earth meant bringing them down to face the judgment of God. And while believers are told that they shouldn't fear those who can kill the body, but have no power to cast the soul into hell, the fact is, if you're an unbeliever, whoever kills you also consigns you to the divine judgment and facilitates casting you into hell, into destruction. So again, the root word is that root of from which we get the term abaddon, which is a word used to describe hell as a place of spiritual destruction. It's the same word, destroyed. The Jews have slain and destroyed 500 men in Shushan the palace, and the 10 sons of Haman. Now, not only does the king call attention to the 500 slain, but quite specifically, he notes the killing of the 10 sons of Haman. Again, there is no sign of any animosity toward the Jews for what they've done. The way the king talks about this seems to indicate he's solidly on their side in the conflict. And as I noted previously, these 10 sons were almost certainly members of Haman's family who were highly positioned and placed through nepotism, placed by their father somewhere in the government or the administration of the kingdom. Now, that's a problem for them. And if you remember early on, Esther had not demanded they be killed when they had Haman hanged. That should have been warning enough for them to leave. So they had warning, but they didn't. And as members of Haman's family, knowing what had happened to their father, they could never be trusted to support the true religion. They could never be trusted to come around. Instead, they would have been chief suspects in any attempts to undermine the faith and its public expressions. They would have been suspect in any movement against the king or the throne. So the king continues and says, what have they done in the rest of the king's provinces? Now, some have thought that the king here is shocked. You know, he's saying, oh, they've killed 500 here. What have they done everywhere else? I think it's not so much shock, but he's sort of musing aloud, given the context. Again, he's sort of saying, look, they've managed to kill 500 people here. Imagine what they've done in the rest of the empire. They've managed to rack up this kind of body count here. I can't even imagine what the number is going to be when it comes in from the provinces. So it may be that he's wondering whether the success of the Jews had been as effective throughout the provinces or governing districts as it had been in Shushan the fortress. Note, too, here that he is asking the queen. This isn't so much then to ascertain the facts of it all, because the queen would have known probably less than he would in this matter. What he seems to be doing is presenting this information to her as expressive of the gift that he'd given her. And if that's the case, then I think we're warranted in understanding that what he's seeking from her is, he's telling her this, sort of boasting about it, and waiting to get some sign of approbation or approval from her. He wants to know if she's pleased. Is she satisfied with all of this? You know, in his mind, he probably thinks, well, surely this must be enough for her. And yet, you know, he has to stop and think. Then again, she's a woman. But the fact is, this teaches us something about this relation between the state and the established church. And that is, the state really has nothing to teach, nor can it applaud its own actions as morally sound. It has to wait. It has to seek the counsel of the church to be sure that its application of justice has been correct. He's given the support and the concurrence of the crown to the defense of the faithful. But what if there's still something lacking here? And so the king continues. He says, now what is thy petition? And seeing what has transpired here in the fortress or the palace complex, now what? And I say, if you didn't understand his favorable disposition prior to this, I don't think there's any way of seeing this in any other way than this is clearly his favorable disposition toward the Jews, or at least toward Esther. And here, once more, he puts forward the first of this twofold question that he keeps putting to the queen throughout the book of Esther. He says, what is thy petition? Now remember, that word connotes a demand or a formal request. That's like saying what the king is asking is to know the law that is a formal shape of what Esther would like. So he's asking, in some respect, do the events of the day, do they fulfill the letter of your demand? Because this is more like the letter of the law. And if not, he says, what else needs to be done to see that that is met? What is thy petition, and it shall be granted thee. So he says, whatever else needs to be done, he says, shall be done. And that's another pledge on the part of the king. All that stands within my power, additionally, shall be given to see that your demand, that the letter of the law is satisfied here. But he goes on, doesn't he? He says, or what is thy request further? And that word translated request here, and I pointed this out some time ago, but let me review that. It means more along the lines of a wish or desire. And so if he's consulting with the church, this is sort of him saying, what's the spirit of the law? First, tell me what the law is. What's your petition? Now tell me the spirit of the law, your request, your further request. What more could you possibly wish to see done in the matter? I think that if we look at it this way, what we see as we consider the king as a type of a magistrate being brought into conformity with the gospel, what we see is a king seeking not only to know the letter of the law, but to know the spirit of the law. And he, in doing this, he's demonstrating his concern is not merely an outward compliance with the demand of the queen. He wants to share with her desires in that law, in the spirit of the law. What's thy request further? And it shall be done. Again, finally, the king here assures her it will be done. He wants his desires now to be conformed to her desires. Right? So he can see that her demands are followed not only in the letter, as I said, but in the spirit. Now here, the king makes a grand offer, if possible, bigger than the one he'd made earlier. Because you see, before he offered up half of the kingdom, here he's proffering more. What more? I offered you half of the kingdom, but if I need to do more to fulfill the spirit of the law, let's do it. Then said Esther, if it please the king, let it be granted to the Jews, which are in Shushan, to do tomorrow also according unto this day's decree, and let Haman's sons be hanged upon the gallows. Then said Esther. So in response to the questions of the king, the queen now responds. But notice here, when she speaks, our attention is not drawn to her royal status. She speaks to him as his wife. Unlike the name of the king, which remains unmentioned, Esther is mentioned again and again by name. And here she, like her name, signifies she's a star. She shows herself to be a star fixed in the firmament of God. She's steady in what she's doing. Right? She is a fixed star. She could have thought best to remain silent, right? I mean, if you think about the proposition, she could have been content with the advantage that the Jews had now achieved. Instead, she knows she mustn't allow any remnant of wickedness to remain unchallenged in the kingdom. It's not the duty of the church to compromise with evil. She must speak until the righteousness of God has been fulfilled according to the law given her from on high. Now, some have thought that Esther has now entered into the spirit of the Persian queen. But it seems that the absence of her title actually indicates that she's speaking from what she is, without reference to her establishment in the state. In other words, she's speaking not as though her preferment or establishment of the state, as has happened in some national establishments, the church is corrupted by that. But she's not been corrupted by that. She's still speaking the truth. She's not changing what she's saying simply because she's the queen. She's speaking as Esther. And as Esther always has and always will. Without reference at all to the fact that she is queen. And that's her power. Yes, she's queen, but her power is that she's also the wife. She is married to the king. Then said Esther, if it please the king. Now, literally, the Hebrew says, if unto the king it is good. But notice, her answer is deferential. It's true, Esther speaks with the authority of the word of God. But we need to remember this. The power of the church is not magisterial. The church does not command. She can only persuade. Remember back there in 2 Corinthians 10, her weapons are not carnal, but they are mighty. It's important that the magistrate, the king, sees and acts in accordance with his own conscience in this matter. She's provoking him and persuading him to give conscientious acknowledgement to what he's about to do. She's asking him to see the goodness of what she's demanding so he can add his authority to it in all aspects, circa sacra. He's not going to determine the faith of the church, but he is going to defend the faith of the church, and doing so, he needs to be convinced that it's a faith worth defending. It's the duty, then, of the king in a place, in a state where there's a national establishment. The king should act conscientiously and not simply upon an implicit faith. You see, a big part of the problem with national establishments in the past was that magistrates followed the church implicitly without knowing for themselves whether or not something was good and true. And that contributed to the rise of the system of popery, which was resisted and condemned by the Protestant reformers. We don't want to make that mistake again. And Esther doesn't want the king to make that kind of mistake. He's a coordinate power. If he's going to act on behalf of the church, he needs to be able to do so conscientiously, to be able to say, I know that this is good. I'm not just doing it because the church is telling me to do it. But I hear the voice of the true religion speaking in the church, and I'm responding to that. I see the goodness and the justness of that. If it please the king, she says, let it be granted to the Jews which are in Shushan. Now note, her request respects the Jews in Shushan only. By this, we should actually understand now the Jews throughout the city of Shushan. The slaughter of the 500 was most likely referring only to those who were inside the fortress or the palace of Shushan. So if we can imagine Shushan as a complex, the capital of the Persian Empire, there is at the center of this large city, there is in the center of this walled inner city in which is the palace. And the 500 were killed in that inner city, but now she's asking for another day to go out into the rest of that city outside of the walls. This further demand indicates she doubts that this slaughter had been carried out at least effectively throughout the city itself. And so from the point of view of security, that this idea of leaving hostile and active enemies remaining would be to invite a future insurrection or a coup attempt. Not a good idea to let that go on. So she seeks additional permissions. The second decree, if you remember, had restricted the killing to the single day of the 13th of Adar. Esther appears to have some awareness that there's some unfinished business for the Jews outside the palace gate. So she makes this request. Let it be granted to the Jews which are in Shushan to do tomorrow as according unto this day's decree. Literally it says, let the Jews be granted tomorrow also to do according to today's decree. Now by this, she certainly meant that they should be allowed not only to defend themselves, but also that they would be permitted to take vengeance upon their enemies. So she's seeking a special addendum, a coda, to that decree that would permit them to have additional time to continue the battle against their enemies. Again, I think it's important that we understand that she has reason, some reason, to believe that some of Haman's faction remains active outside the palace walls. Now, the rabbis have suggested another very interesting reason for this second day. And I think it's actually worth considering. They say the first day had been chosen by Haman, casting Pur, the lot, divining the powers of the constellations of the stars. He had done that in conjunction with his astrology. And that he thought that the day that was chosen by the lot was the day most likely to allow for the destruction of the Jews. So on this very day, as we now know, right, the Lord saved his people despite Haman thinking that fortune and the gods had already pretty well guaranteed him victory. So the rabbis suggest that by choosing a second date, what Esther is demonstrating to these heathen Persians is this. Haman had not merely miscalculated. Because, you know, some of them might have thought, oh boy, maybe he miscalculated. When he cast the lot, maybe he fell on the wrong day. And if he'd only fallen on the right day, we would have succeeded. So she's going to demonstrate to them, and she's going to make clear that the Lord is God indeed, and there's none else. The heathen gods are nothing, their powers are non-existent, and he can let us kill you on any day of the year he wants. And I think that's as good an explanation as any as to why this happens here. It's certainly in keeping with the idea of an overruling providence. Let it be granted to the Jews which are in Shushan to do tomorrow also according unto this day's decree, and let Haman's 10 sons be hanged upon the gallows. Finally, she makes it clear she's not satisfied with the fact that Haman's sons have only been killed. Right? She says their bodies need to be put on display, and that needs to be upon the very gallows or that very tree erected by their father. Remember how high he'd made it? He made it 50 cubits high. It's like several stories high. So there's plenty of room there. So along with their father, the 10 sons of Haman were hanged upon the tree for their hostility and treachery against the true religion. Hanging them made them a public spectacle, showing all the people what would happen to anybody who attempts to destroy the people of God. Now, before I conclude, I want to go back to something I raised briefly last time. Regarding the orthography and the names. Before I get to that, let me just mention something. When it's questioned why the Jews require the reading of the book of Esther for Purim, wherein its basis is found, but that they don't even consider the book of Maccabees inspired and do not require the reading of that on Hanukkah, even though that book provides the historical rationale for that celebration, they have a very interesting response. Here's what they say. They say Maccabees is only historical, whereas Esther is prophetical, meaning it's inspired. And by this, what they mean is Esther has a meaning that extends beyond its original audience and is intended for the edification of the people of God in time to come. Whereas Maccabees, they are very clear, does not have live character. Now, that goes to the defense of Protestants in rejecting the book of Maccabees as not being inspired. The Jews didn't believe it was, and that is a pretty clearly stated by them with regard to this difference. But how much that distinction plays into what I'm about to mention here isn't too hard to understand from the modern Jewish perspective. So remember as well that Esther speaks here, according to the rabbis, to God. Right? Because the name of the king is not mentioned. It just simply says the king. And so she speaks to the king and asks for the hanging of the 10 sons tomorrow. Now, on this word tomorrow, the rabbis, particularly Rashi, but some others, I believe, Rashi in his comments on Exodus 13, verse 14, he noted that there is a tomorrow which is now, and there's a tomorrow which is later. From this, some rabbis, modern rabbis, have concluded that what Esther was asking God was not only to allow the hanging of Haman's 10 sons on the morrow after she's speaking to the king at that time, you know, the tomorrow now, which was now, but she was asking for this hanging of 10 to be repeated in the future. As I said last week, there's some peculiar orthographic features in the Hebrew text in the verses giving the names of Haman's sons. In Parshandatha, the Tav, the TH sound, Parmashta, the Shin, the SH sound, in Vajazatha, the Z, the Zion, the smaller, the Z sound, and the Vav, the V, the larger V. In Hebrew, the last letter, the Vav, signifies the number 6, the big letter. The three smaller letters, the Zion is a number 7, the Shin, the sound, the SH sound is 300, and the TH sound of Tal is 400. So the total of the small letters would be 707. Now, if the large letter indicates the millennium, that is the thousand-year period, it would signify the sixth millennium from the creation, because the Jews' calendar runs from the creation. So, if you were to add all those together, you would arrive at the year 5,707, or what we would know as 1946. Now, the seventh day of the Feast of Tabernacles each year is called Hoshanah Rabbah. And it's considered to be the final day of the divine judgment in which the fate of the new year would be determined. So it's the date when the verdict that was issued on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur is finalized in Jewish thinking. Now, that would have been on the 21st of Tishrei, which in the year 1946 fell on October 16th. Now, it just so happens that on that day, 11 high-ranking Nazis were supposed to be hanged, but only 10 actually were hanged because Hermann Göring had committed suicide the evening before. From this, the Jews, of course, have derived many other parallels comparing the threat that they experienced under the reign of the Nazis with that under Haman. Now, while that may seem compelling to many people who harbor erroneous views about the Jews and their place in prophecy, the conclusion is drawn from a series, I think, of false premises, not least of which is a denial that the church is Israel now. It's equally possible to see, for example, that we're dealing with two numbers if we go from the year that this was spoken, which would have been 479 BC, and we then subtract the 307, We come to the year 172, 171, which is the year when Menelaus becomes the high priest, and he ends up leading the Maccabean rebellion for the Jews. And then if we add another 400 or subtract another 400, we come down to the year 229. And that's the year in which the Neo-Persian Empire was finally consolidated. And that would be the last expression of the Persian Empire in 650-51 AD. It would fall to Islam. And so I think that, you know, we have just as much right to do those kinds of things. Fact is this, the Jews do have a place, and prophecy will once again encompass them in a very special way. But that is once they've professed faith in Jesus Christ. All right. By the way, as interesting as their reasoning is on the Nazis, the fact is, if we look at what happened here with Haman and the Jews, none of the Jews died. Right? But according to them, at least according to their number that they threw out in the 50s, 6 million of them died. We know a lot died, but you know, 6 million is a fabricated, that's a symbolical number. Anyway, so in conclusion, we should learn from Esther's request here that we mustn't rest until we've mortified sin in the flesh. That's really, she doesn't rest. Just as a little leaven is going to leaven the whole lump, so the little foxes are going to spoil the vine. Sin that's tolerated, sin that's harbored, even if it's not actively nourished, it's going to remain a threat to our spiritual security. It has to be rooted out. God's deliverance to the Jews was not intended to be only in the main, but in the whole. And likewise, our spiritual well-being depends upon putting into practice the duty of mortification, not in the main, but in the whole. Too often, it seems men are inclined to tolerate what shouldn't be tolerated, and they often will say of their favorite sins, it's just a small one. But Esther understood, and we should understand from what she did, that there are no small enemies to the faithful, but that all resistance must be rooted out. And that's something we can learn from Esther when she approaches a king. Amen.